Welcome to our broadcast in the second of the Civil Discourse series, hosted by the Institute of Public Affairs and Civic Engagement on the campus of Salisbury University. This is Don Rush. This evening, the discussion will focus on affecting change in a political world, with a look at the legislative process, along with the role and techniques used by advocacy groups. We begin with our moderator, Phil Tillman.
Welcome to everyone to the Forum for Civil Discourse. The subject of tonight's forum will be affecting change in a political world. Our first participant is Dr. Adam Hoffman. Dr. Hoffman is director of PACE, the Institute of Political Affairs and Civic Engagement. I have civil on my mind, I think, here at Salisbury University. He's assistant professor of political science, has a PhD from the University of Maryland, and also a law degree from Albany Law School. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Adam Hoffman.
What I want to focus on very briefly this evening is change at the state level. If you want to achieve significant change that impacts the entire state, you must deal with Maryland state laws. Because you have to deal with Maryland state law, the entity, the institution that you have to deal with is, of course, the Maryland legislature. The General Assembly, we're talking about a body with 188 elected officials, 141 in the House of Delegates, 47 in the Senate. Both bodies currently are made up of a majority of Democrats. So why should a state legislator, one of these 188 men or women, actually listen to anything you have to say? Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, being an elected official in Maryland, or any elected official, is one of the few jobs that every few years you have to run, and ordinary people have the ability to either rehire you or fire you. The other thing is actually campaign contributions. We've heard a lot about this. We've heard about moves to have campaign finance reform, that there's too much money in politics, and there is. But the fact is that at the state legislative level, for instance, when a delegate runs for office in Maryland, he or she spends about raises about $35,000. Senatorial candidates raise about twice that, $75,000 or $80,000. If you could afford it, contributing $25, $50 during an election cycle to a legislator that you agree with, that you see eye to eye, that you think will go to bat for you once they are elected, really does have an influence. $50, that legislator, that legislative office is probably going to return your calls, answer your emails, slightly quicker than someone that did not contribute to their campaign. So it doesn't take a lot to just have a little bit more access than the average constituent. The other thing is volunteering. If you don't have, you know, if you can't afford that, and you really see eye to eye with a particular legislative candidate, volunteer on their campaign. They will remember that when it comes time for you to ask them a favor to grant you access on a particular bill or issue that is of concern to you. The type of communication here is the key, right? It's establishing those relationships through emails, through visits to their district office, visits to Annapolis, regular snail mail letter writing. All these things have that impact of you building a relationship. A bill can be introduced throughout the entire 90 days of the legislative session, which is meeting right now as we speak. The committees in Annapolis are key. They act as gatekeepers to either kill legislation or have bills move along their course of actually becoming law, especially the Rules Committee. Committees do hold public hearings on most bills, on not all bills, but a lot of bills or joint resolutions. And the Department of Legislative Services, you could easily look this up, issues a weekly hearing so that anyone, including ordinary citizens, could sign up and testify on behalf of a bill or in opposition of a bill. Basically, it's your opportunity, it's the opportunity of citizens, lobbyists, interest groups, of persuading the committee to vote either favorably or unfavorably on a piece of legislation, on a bill. At the committee hearings, testimony is heard from the bill's sponsor, other proponents and opponents, which may result in amendment. The final vote of the committee is recorded by a member. After it's voted out of committee, it now returns to the floor of its chamber. So in this case, we're talking about the House. So it goes back to the House for the second reading after consideration of any amendments. If the committee might have changed the bill slightly, the bill is then open up to amendments on the floor. Again, this is the opportunity if you see a particular bill, for instance, the gay marriage bill. There were some legislators who were opposed to that on religious grounds. So attempts were made to pass amendments to change it, where legislators on behalf of constituents said, yes, I will vote for gay marriage, but only with these particular amendments, perhaps, that protect religious institutions. Once the second reading is completed, the presiding officer orders the bill with any adopted amendments printed for a third reading. So now we're moving along in the legislative process. At the third reading, no amendments are presented in the chamber of origin. In this case, we're talking about the House of Delegates. The vote is taken to either pass or reject the bill. If it gets a majority of vote, if it gets the majority, it's passed. If it's passed, then we have to do that same process all over again in the second chamber, in this case, the Senate. If it's amended in the second chamber, the bill is then returned to the House. If the amendments are agreed to, then the bill is voted on as amended. If the amendments are rejected, then the amending chamber, that is, let's say the Senate adds some amendments, may be asked to withdraw the amendments. If it refuses, in other words, if both the Senate and the House can't agree on the exact same version of the bill, then it goes to conference committee, which is made up of people from the Senate and people from the House. The committee sends a report to its recommendation, so each chamber can adopt it or reject it. If the report is adopted, the bill is voted on in each House. Again, it goes to the entire members of all the delegates, of all the senators. And if it's rejected by either House, the bill fails. So you could see there's numerous points. It's a lot easier to actually kill legislation than it is to pass legislation in Annapolis or any legislative body, in fact. Finally, if the bill, the same version of the bill, passes in both houses, the governor has the opportunity to either sign it or veto it. In order to successfully navigate this labyrinth, this legislative process, one thing that you have to remember, and I think some of the other panelists will probably talk about this whole idea of power in numbers. A good metaphor you could use is called the drive-in grassroots success story. This works, I guess, a little bit better with this crowd as opposed to my students who don't know what a drive-in movie was. So when I say the drive-in metaphor, picture that you have a two-seater convertible and you could only bring one representative to the drive-in movie. This is because for every legislative battle, for every issue that you're concerned of, you will often only have one elected official. Maryland's a little different because we have multi-member districts, so sometimes you have two. The film, the drive-in movie, will not be shown until half the spots in the drive-in movie are filled. No matter how hard you try, it's almost impossible, not always, to make any elected official who doesn't represent you in your district care about your request. Again, there are exceptions. The Eastern Shore delegation seems to often work with each other. But for the most part, this is true. The advantage of this is that you are the key to bringing your elected official to the movie. The disadvantage is that the fact is you have to rely on other advocates throughout the state to bring their own legislator in their two-seat convertible or three-seat car to the movie. So the efforts have to be coordinated for the grassroots to have really an impact on a particular bill. So if your particular issue generates 10,000 letters from everyone in the same district, chances are your bill is not going to pass because you're all sharing one car, 10,000 people. It's not going to work. So a good example I brought up currently in the news, right, the gay marriage legislation that just passed the Senate and the House. The fact is that 71 cars or votes had to be filled in the House in order to pass this legislation. In the Senate, 25 cars were filled, right? That means advocates, Equality Maryland, one of the key interest groups, the grassroots organization that was instrumental in passing this legislation, had to lobby in all 71 districts in the House, all 25 districts in the Senate, in order to get the senators and the delegates to vote for this bill. So this whole process, as you could imagine from my description, it's an uphill battle. And when it comes to change in Annapolis, you're often fighting against entrenched insider interests who know how to navigate this labyrinth better than the average person. But the fact is there are a number of grassroots efforts that do succeed in Annapolis. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman. Our second guest, our participant, is Michelle Hughes. Michelle is Executive Director of the Life Crisis Center for the Lower Three Counties of Maryland's Eastern Shore. Formerly Executive Director of the YWCA in Annapolis and Anne Arundel County.
I've been a nonprofit executive for more than 20 years, and I have found the need to influence both elected officials and people who are employed by government in many settings. Sometimes we need to affect small changes. They don't need to have big sweeping legislative answers. Sometimes they can be done by regulation. Sometimes we simply need to point out to government that they've made a mistake or that there's an easier way to do things. One of the easiest things I have ever done in the influencing of government was the parking authority in Salisbury. Anybody who works in downtown Salisbury knows about the parking authority. They control our lives. Mm-hmm. And every parking lot has a waiting list. The waiting list is something that does not change. It is set in stone, apparently. And I very naively went to the parking authority and said, I have been on the waiting list for a parking spot in the parking lot behind my office for 3 years now. Have I moved up on the list? Because I know there are dead people with parking spots in my lot. And they said, no, you're still in the same place. And I said, this doesn't make any sense. There are people who are not downtown anymore. What is happening to their parking spaces? Well, there's nothing we can do about it. Well, I volunteered to pay for the postage to send everybody who parks in that lot or who is on that waiting list a letter asking them if they still needed the parking spot. There's nothing. No, we can't do that. You know, we're not authorized to do that. I said, well, who is authorized to do it? Well, it didn't seem to be anybody's responsibility. I called the mayor's office. It was the mayor's office's responsibility, apparently, because they got the letter written, and I have 5 parking spaces in that lot. That's using your government to effect change. Dead people do not need parking spaces. Mm. About 7 years ago, the then governor made a decision that made all the sense in the world. He decided to streamline procurement for the state. The state would have one contractor who would provide products used by multiple agencies across the state, and in that way control costs, because there'd be one contract, we would know how much things cost, and we would control costs that way. One of the areas where this decision adversely affected both the state and the Lower Shore was in purchasing parts for state cars. Got a whole lot of state cars, and they have to be fixed. The state signed a long-term contract to purchase parts from a large national firm at a fixed price, plus the cost of transporting the parts from the warehouse. 7 years ago, the price of gasoline was significantly lower than it is now. At some point, the transportation costs increased so much that it no longer made sense. However, the people who had originally done the contract were no longer in state government because the governor and his people have changed since then. One day, I was getting my oil changed, and the owner of the place where I got my oil changed mentioned in passing that she could use the state business, but the state couldn't deal with her, even though she would save the state money by buying parts from her. And I said, have you talked to Delegate Conway? And she said, no, you know, I don't want to do that. And I said, I don't know why. He's the man you talk to. He can ask the question. And she said, no, I'm a Republican. I said to her, it may make a difference to you, but it does not make a difference to Delegate Conway. Because if he does something good for you, he thinks you might vote for him the next time. She reluctantly decided that she would get a group of automotive parts suppliers together and they would go and talk to Norm Conway. She called him. She made the appointment. He not only listened to them, he called the secretary of the Department of Budget and Management and the head of the General Services Administration and sat down with them to show them how we could save the state money by using local businesses. People in Annapolis don't understand anybody's local area. It's not just because we're so far away that they don't understand ours. They they don't understand anything outside of state government because that's not what we pay them to do. And they don't know that the state is paying more because it's hard to tell that in a $34.8 billion budget. The cost of an oil filter is not a whole lot of money. But if we talk to our legislators, they can help us with these things. That's what we pay them for. About 20 years ago, I had an intern who played lacrosse. Women's lacrosse is different from men's lacrosse in that women don't wear any head protection. This young woman had been hit in the eye by a lacrosse ball and had had multiple surgeries to her eye socket. And she wanted to bring up the issue of women's lacrosse and how dangerous it was, and wanted women's lacrosse teams to protect their players. She got a resolution introduced in the Maryland House of Delegates to support protecting girls who played lacrosse from these kind of injuries, and was going nowhere. We bought a box of pink neon lacrosse balls. You ever seen those practice balls the kids use? They're the balls that are not good enough to be used in a game, but they dye them pink and green and yellow so they can be seen in practice. We sent one of these balls to each member of the House of Delegates with a card that said, "What if your daughter was hit in the eye with this?" The resolution passed, and now most women's lacrosse teams encourage eye protection and mouth guards for their players. It was a very simple thing. It does not affect state law. The state's not mandating that, you know, phys ed classes have eye protection for lacrosse players. But it gave the schools in the state a sense that this was important. I have often been involved in the passing of legislation, and a piece of legislation, and this is where I'm going to disagree with Dr. Hoffman, a piece of legislation that was passed because of a group of women who were the mothers of children who had been sexually abused on the Lower Shore. We had a support group, because I work at Life Crisis and we deal with abused children and their families, and a group of mothers who were in a support group who were very upset about the number of cases that were either nullprost or had to be dropped because of a strange fluke in the law that said that a social worker could report a conversation with a child who had been abused, but a counselor, something called an LCPC, a licensed professional counselor, could not give testimony. Mostly it was because the law was written before there was any such thing as an LCPC. But the state law had never been changed. And we were losing a great many of these cases because a large number of these therapists on the Lower Shore are LCPCs. The law needed to be changed. And these women were really upset about what could they do to make certain that the people who had abused their children would be punished. There was at that time no one on the either Judiciary Committee in the House or the Judicial Proceedings Committee in the Senate from the Lower Shore. There is now someone from the Lower Shore on Judiciary. We went to the chairman of the committee, Senator Brian Frosch, who represents Montgomery County. I took these ladies to Annapolis. We sat down with Senator Frosch and explained to him why our state's attorney was losing these cases. And we discovered that we were not the only ones. We were just the ones who brought it up. They were having the same issue all around the state, but no one had asked a legislator to bring it up. Last session, we introduced legislation to make it acceptable for an LCPC to give hearsay testimony about sexual abuse of children. The bill passed, was signed by the governor, and is currently the law in Maryland. It has been used already twice in this county to put someone who was a sexual predator of children in jail. Came from a group of women who were just devastated over what had happened to their children. Legislators want to hear from you. They want you to tell them what your concerns are that they might be able to fix. That's why they are there. And any of them who do not wish to hear from you won't be in the legislature for very long. I have known legislators for the last 35 years in this state, and I have very seldom come across one who does not want to hear from you in the state legislature. And the ones that I have seen who don't want to hear from you don't stay in the legislature. So you can be comfortable calling your legislator, writing to your legislator, and mostly on the federal level. You have two U.S. senators in this state who are extraordinarily responsive. And you need to know that because they will listen to your concerns. Sometimes they can't do anything about them, but they will try. And that's really all we can expect of our legislators, is that they will try for us. And I think that here we're very fortunate in that most of them do. Now, there are hundreds of stories about bills and accessing the legislature, but you should just know that it is not hard and that you should not be afraid to do it or concerned that they will not pay any attention to you.
Thank you, Michelle. Our third participant, Vincent DeMarco, is Executive Director of Maryland Citizens Health Initiative, Statewide Health Care for All campaign.
It's convenient.
Featured in a recent book, The DeMarco Factor, Transforming Public Will into Political Power by Michael Perchuk.
Thank you, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here and an honor to be on such a distinguished panel. And what I'd like to talk to you about a little bit is a process that a group of us, including Mike, have come up with over the last couple of decades on a way to move public health issues when you have a situation where there's broad popular support but a powerful vested interest opponent, a powerful vested interest industry or group that opposes what we're doing because they make money off the status quo. And in particular, we've worked on issues of reducing gun violence, reducing teen smoking and underage drinking, and expanding health care. And I've worked on these issues for many, many years, and one of the things I've learned is that the overwhelming majority of Marylanders, and I think the overwhelming majority of Americans, strongly support the public health measures that we have identified that really do something about reducing these problems. But of course, not everybody. And we all know that not everybody, and I come across them fairly often. And recently, in my own neighborhood in Northeast Baltimore City, I've gone to my community association to get their support for our proposals. And I first went to get their support for reducing gun violence, and they endorsed our plan to keep guns away from criminals, which was great. And then a few years later, I went to get their support for raising cigarette tax, for reducing teen smoking. And this really big guy at the front of the audience got up and said, "Aren't you the guy who came after my guns? And now you're trying to take my cigarettes. Next thing I know, you're coming after my ham." Well, I promised I'd leave his ham alone. I didn't tell him I was a vegetarian because he probably would have shot me. But we calmed him down, and they endorsed our proposal, which was great. But that gentleman represented the very loud minority that opposes us. And I remember recently I wrote a letter to the Sun supporting tobacco and alcohol taxes, and one guy wrote back, "There's that DeMarco again. He's upset when anybody's happy," which isn't true. And Mike will tell you that I like being happy. But they are opposed to us, and they're loud, but they're not the problem. The problem is the tobacco industry that makes money off sales of cigarettes, including the kids, and the alcohol lobby, which are very, very powerful. So how do you overcome that? Well, a group of us, including Mike, as I said, have come up with a six-step process, which I'm going to talk about a little bit. But first, I want to tell you about some of the results. 10 years ago, when we started this work, Maryland had one of the worst records in the country in health care for lower-income people, and we had a really, really high smoking rate. And our cigarette tax was abysmally low. So in 1999, a group of us started a campaign to raise that cigarette tax. And what this chart shows is that over the last decade, Maryland's smoking rate has dropped 32%. And that's double the national average of about 15%. That's resulted in over 200,000 fewer people smoking, 70,000 lives saved of people who would have died horrible tobacco-caused deaths. And this chart is up there if you want to take one home with you and show it to all your friends. But what this chart shows, if you look at it, is that the drops in cigarette sales happened every time we raised the cigarette tax. A dramatic decrease has happened those times. And that shows the impact of this public policy that we've been pushing for. And in addition, the most recent time we raised the cigarette tax in 2007, The money was allocated by the O'Malley Brown administration to expand health care to over 300,000 people. Before that law took effect, Maryland, the richest state in the country, was 44th in the nation in health care for lower income people. 44th, and we're now 14th. And that's a dramatic expansion of health care to over 300,000 people. And that only happened because we were able to overcome the opposition of the tobacco lobby and pass this tobacco tax, which helped to fund that expansion. And this healthcare expansion has really helped many, many people. And there's a book we put together here, which you all can get a hold of if you want, called Faces of Maryland's Newly Insured, which tells stories of people from one end of the state to the other who've benefited from this healthcare expansion. And we worked a lot with Michelle to get the message out about it through the 211 number and 311 number in Baltimore to let people know about it. But this has been really, really dramatic. I'll tell you one story of a woman in Garrett County on the other end of the state who came to a press conference we had, and she told us how she couldn't get health care for many, many years, and her husband worked full-time. She was raising kids, couldn't get health care. She was desperate. She went to the Garrett County Health Department and she asked for, is there health care for children at least? And they said, yes, and now under this new law that Governor O'Malley signed, there's health care for you also. She didn't know about it. She got her Medicaid card under this new law. A few weeks later, she was feeling ill, and if she hadn't had this new health care card, this Medicaid card, she would have tried to sleep it off, as many uninsured people do. Instead, she went to a doctor, and the doctor said, Ms. Moon, thank goodness you came here. You were developing something that would have killed you. But thanks to this new card, your life, we can save your life now. And she came to our press conference and said, thank you for saving my life. That's what she said to all of us, including the delegates there and everyone else. And that's the kind of stories we hear all across Maryland. So this success has been dramatic. But again, how did it happen? I wanted to start by telling you there's this great news. And most recently, we passed for the first time in 40 years an increase in the alcohol tax, which has been reducing underage drinking and alcohol abuse, and the money's been used for expanding health care for people. These have been very difficult campaigns to succeed in against very vested, powerful interests. The way we overcame that, a six-step process that resulted in these successes. And the six steps are, first, when you have a problem, whether it's too many kids smoking, too many guns on the street, underage drinking, or no health care for people, first, come up with a smart solution. Come up with a smart, evidence-based plan that deals with the problem, whether it's increasing a cigarette tax or the alcohol tax or a health care plan. And talk to experts like people at universities like SU or Hopkins or wherever you can. Come up with a smart plan. Second, do some polling. Test the public support behind your issue. When we started our tobacco tax campaigns, everybody in Annapolis was saying, get lost. You'll never pass a tobacco tax increase here. Impossible. Everybody from the Senate president on down. But we said, well, we want to know, what do the people of Maryland think? Do they agree with this? So we did polling and found overwhelming public support for increasing the cigarette tax. But that's not enough. You should go a little deeper and find out how strong is the support. So we asked a series of three questions. In the next election, for whom are you going to vote, a Democrat or a Republican? Straight up question. Second question, what if the Democrat supports the public policy, whether it's a tobacco tax increase or gun violence laws or whatever it is, and a Republican opposes it? Number three, what if the Republican supports it and a Democrat opposes it? Those are the three questions. When we asked the first question, we always find that in Maryland, a Democrat's up by about 10 points. When we asked the second question, with the Democrats supporting and Republican opposing, suddenly the Democrats' margin goes up by about 20 points. But when we asked the third question, whether the Republican supports it and Democrat opposes it, now the Republicans ahead. That shows us is that not only the people support what we're proposing, they feel strongly enough about it to make voting decisions based on it. Now that's important information. Just telling someone in the legislature that 70% of your constituents support something is a big yawn. But if you tell them your constituents feel strongly enough about this that they'll vote for or against you, depending on how your position, now that's important to them. And we got a lot of support for this. Interestingly, when we asked the demographics on the tobacco question, we found that the category of voter most likely to switch to the candidate who supports the tobacco tax were Republican women. Least likely were Republican men. So they don't talk about that issue over dinner. But it shows that key swing groups would really care about this issue. So second, we did that polling. That showed that there's support behind our issue. Third, build a powerful coalition. And this is the key to our success, is to, when we found out that there's strong popular support for our issue, we did something which is really unpopular with a lot of advocates. And I have to say this all around the country, that one of the biggest mistakes advocates make is spend all their time talking to legislators, beating their heads against the wall when there's a powerful opponent who's beat them year after year after year. And my advice always is, in that situation, spend some time ignoring the legislature. Make believe Annapolis doesn't exist. Talk instead to the people of the state, the people of your jurisdiction. So we spent on some issues several years building a powerful coalition. And instead of asking the legislators do they want a tobacco tax increase, we instead asked the United Methodist Church, the NAACP, the Urban League, League of Women Voters. We asked groups all across the state, what do you think about a tobacco tax increase? And how did we do that? We did that with a document, which is a resolution. And there are a couple of important things about a resolution. It's a document that says, whereas, because, or whereas, whatever way you want to use it, there's this problem resolved, we support a tobacco tax increase, or whatever your objective is. Number one rule, make this one page. So many of us like to write 10-page documents about everything. And if you go to somebody who's very busy and say, can you read this 10-page document? You're not going to get the first base. But if it's one page and you have everything succinctly in there about what you want, what the problem is, you could say, can you take this to your organization and support it? And people do that. People will do that. And you will find across the state that if you're talking about something that is important to people, you can get their support. Now, it's hard work, and you have to go out there and really beat the bushes and really knock on doors, and it could take a while because people have processes you have to go through, but it's a very critical part of the work. Now, what organization do you go to? There are thousands, millions of organizations. It depends partly on your issue. If you're working on the gun violence issue, you should go to victims groups, police groups, groups like that. If you're working on tobacco, make sure you go to healthcare groups. Alcohol, make sure you go to youth, underage drinking groups, etc. But on every issue I've worked on, I've always spent a lot of time building support in the faith community for four key reasons. First is that faith leaders have a moral authority that policymakers have to listen to. They don't always do what they say, but they have to at least pay attention. Second, the faith community is where the grassroots are, where the people are who can make the calls, write the letters, go to visit the legislators. You can find people to do these things. Third is diversity. You build tremendous diversity when you reach out to the faith community, religious, economic, social, and political diversity. And fourth, media. The media loves the faith community taking on special interests like the tobacco lobby or the gun lobby. We did a great press conference with top faith leaders in Maryland when we launched our first tobacco tax campaign. I'll never forget the head of the United Methodist Church said that he wanted to kick the butts of the tobacco companies. He was very upset when that wasn't in the paper. He wanted that in the paper. But what was in the paper was the head of the Lutheran church saying that for years, the Lutherans had made fun of the Methodists and the Baptists for getting all upset about tobacco. And the bishop said, I'm here to say the Methodists were right and we Lutherans were wrong. We're going to join with the Methodists to take this on. And that was in the paper. And as a result, the front page article in the Sun was clerics back tobacco tax increase. And that was really, really powerful. It's a kind of media you can't buy when you get some support like that. So for those reasons, I always encourage groups to reach out to the faith community. Now, one little, I won't go into this because I could talk about this for 5 hours, some legal issues of, isn't this, some groups are afraid to get resolutions like this signed because they say, that's lobbying and I'm not allowed to do a lot of lobbying. I only have a little bit of money assigned to lobbying. It's very important if you're going to work on these issues to talk to smart lawyers like Mike Prettl. And Mike has been my lawyer for many years, and he's quoted as saying that someone said to him, you must be a really good lawyer. I mean, kept Vinnie DeMarco out of jail all these years, and he didn't deny it. But what Mike is really good at and what you want to know is not only what you can't do, but what you can do. And the fact is, if you take a resolution like this and go to Michelle's group or the United Methodist Church or even Salisbury University, some entity, would you sign this support of a tobacco tax? That is not lobbying. Now, when you ask them to contact your legislature, that's lobbying, and there are some limits on that. but it's not lobbying to build this powerful coalition. So let me just show you kind of a result, and this is the list. This is now we have over 350 organizations that have endorsed this so far, and we only started a few months ago. On our Healthcare for All coalition, we had over 1,200 because we built this powerful coalition. And when you do that, you have a lot more clout than if it's just you individually going up there. So that's step three. Step four is use the media. Use the media to the hilt to get your message out. We are usually have a lot less money than our powerful vested interest opponents. And you got to use the media. And there are two kinds of media. There's earned media and paid media. Earned meaning media like getting an article in a newspaper, like that Faith Leaders article I talked about. You know, I like to nudge people. And Mike will know that I call him often at 6 a.m. in the morning. And I like to call and email a lot. But I can't call and email 5 million Marylanders. So I use the media like a giant telephone. That's the way to get the message out. So you try to generate articles like that Faith Leaders article. You try to get op-eds, just a recent op-ed about the new healthcare laws going on in Annapolis. That's a really good message. Then there's, of course, paid media, which is harder because it costs money. But we try to maximize that by using radio. Radio is a very effective way for organizations that don't have a lot of money to get their message out. And a lot of times, if you have a good radio ad, earned media will pick it up and write articles about it. So you use the media to the hilt. Five is make your issue an election issue. I firmly believe that when you're really trying to overcome vested interest opposition, that's very, very powerful. You have to use our election process and make the candidates take a position on your issue. Now, we never endorse candidates. We don't give lots of money to candidates. But what we do is at election time, we demand that they endorse us. So that resolution I showed you earlier, we turned it into a document for candidates. Now, I used to call that a pledge, candidates' pledge, until one time one delegate said to me, Vinny, I'm tired of pledges. There are all these anti-tax pledges and everything. I'm never, ever signing a pledge again. I said, well, delegate, what if we called it a candidate resolution? She said, I'll sign that. Okay, well, that's what we call them, candidate resolutions. But what we do is, come election time, we send that document to every candidate running for office all across the state. And then we unleash our coalition on them. And suddenly, these candidates who are thinking they're going to win just because of their good looks or whatever they have in their background are suddenly being asked, did you sign that resolution yet? And they got to pay attention. Because, yes, it's very important to do the kind of lobbying that you heard about earlier that Michelle does so well of going and talk to legislators. But when you talk to them during a legislative session, you're one thing. You might be a constituent. You might be important to them. But they have other things on their mind besides you. During election time, you're very important to them. They may want some money from you. They may want your community group support. But if your first question is, did you sign that resolution yet? They're going to be listening. And we have done this in every election cycle since 1994, and it has worked. And sometimes there are some funny results, too. I remember the first time we did this on the gun issue in 1994, we sent them out, and there was a moderate, a very nice man from Baltimore County, Senator Vernon Boozer, whose resolution came back signed right away, and I was thrilled. We put out our list of who's endorsed it with him. I got an angry call from Senator Boozer. How dare you put my name on that list? I never signed that. Well, I faxed him the document with his signature on it. He called me back meekly and said, well, my secretary signed it without telling me. And I said, well, Senator, nothing I can do about that. Do you want me to hold a press conference taking your name off the list? He said, no. So we got the better end of that deal. But in the most recent election, we had something else happen where we were doing the same kind of process on the alcohol tax. And Senator George Della, who used to be a senator from South Baltimore, was someone who had always opposed everything we'd done, and I was sure he was never going to sign it. It came back, his document came signed. I thought it was another secretarial mistake, but what happened instead that time, he was being challenged by a much younger candidate who ended up beating him, but that younger candidate, Senator Bill Ferguson, signed our resolution right away, and what I heard was that in the inner circles of his campaign, he said, I hate that, DeMarco, but I better sign this or Ferguson's going to use it against me, and he did. But why did he feel like he had to do that? He felt like he had to do that because we had such a powerful coalition. And we have been using the media and getting the message out, and he was hearing from his constituents over and over again. And as a result, each time we've done this, we have ended up with, after the election, almost a majority of the Senate and House come into the next session having signed our document. And that's a tremendous, powerful way to start. And that brings you to step six, which is getting your legislation passed. And then you do the basic work that we always do of the hearings, make sure you have smart people at the hearings, make sure you continue to do press conferences and continue to do all the lobbying you heard about earlier, which is so very important. But on these issues where you have a powerful vested interest opponent, it really is important, I believe, to do these other steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, before getting to 6. And so many advocates go from like step 1 to step 6 and forget everything else in the middle. Now, you may be asking me, and I'll close with this, while you're doing all the other steps, where are all these powerful opponents? Where's the powerful tobacco lobby and the alcohol lobby while you're making an election issue and everything else? Well, with all due respect, I like to compare them to cockroaches. The reason is they do well in the dark. In the halls of Annapolis, when nobody's looking, they're in control. They're everywhere. But you turn the lights on, they scatter. There was never any press conference by tobacco companies saying smoking is good or anything like that. We had the field to ourselves, and it happens every single time. So that when we get to Annapolis, where they're usually strong, there's this powerful current of public opinion overcoming them. So this six-step process, I think, works. And the embarrassing titled book, The Marco Factor, Transforming Public Will into Political Power, is a book that describes the successes of this process with lots of great quotes from Mike Prettle. So I urge you to take a look at it. It's by Mike Perchik, so I don't get a penny off it.
And our final presenter is Mike Prettle, previously advertised by Vincent DeMarco, current chairman of the Wicomico Neighborhood Congress, employed as a general counsel to the American Urological Association, pro bono counsel to numerous environmental and other nonprofit organizations.
You've heard all about how things are done in Annapolis. They don't let me go to Annapolis. I'm staying home while my dear wife Michelle and Denise and are lobbying the legislature. I want to talk a little bit not about the legislative process, but about how some of this change can get done locally, or how I would suggest that we use some of the power that we have in the community to accomplish some of these sorts of things. What we don't do a good job of in this community is what I call these infrastructure organizations, the local neighborhood associations. We don't have that infrastructure that would be useful to accomplish many of the things that need to get done, not in Annapolis necessarily, but at the local level. As many of you know, when Mr. Pollitt was elected our first county executive, he came up with this idea of creating what he called a neighborhood Congress. And it was all well and good. Except once we finished creating this thing or finished devising this thing, we couldn't find any neighborhoods because there aren't any. There are very, very few organized community organizations that that have an interest in fighting these sorts of battles and joining a neighborhood Congress. And frankly, I hate to say the thing fell flat on its face, but it really has not gotten very far because we have not been able to generate the kind of infrastructure that we felt we could. I think it was a good idea, but it was sort of the wrong idea for this community, which is a more conservative community than the one that I'm from, and it's not really doesn't develop along the lines of a more urban pattern, if you will. You can't organize around organizing, and what we came up with was the idea that you have to organize around issues. We did find an issue 2 years or so ago. We had some people came to the Neighborhood Congress from some of the homeowner associations around the outskirts of Salisbury. And we may not have a whole lot of neighborhood associations, but we have a lot of homeowner associations. And they were all having battles, problems with things like foreclosures and with people abandoning their houses because they were so-called underwater. And we had a series of meetings. We brought down very crackerjack lawyer from Baltimore who works on foreclosure issues. And for about 6 months or a year, we did a lot of active work, and we had a good core of 50 or 75 people that were very much involved in these homeowner association issues. We looked at people's bylaws and revised some covenants and that sort of thing. But unfortunately, once that issue was sort of taken care of, they all went away. And there's no continuation in the neighborhood Congress. And I'm here not really to preach to you, but I'm sort of frustrated because we tried very hard with a lot of effort of a lot of very good and smart people to try to make this concept work. We're going to revise the model. And this past fall, two things happened. One, my good friend Dr. Rutenberg came up with this idea of having these civil dialogues and did a number of good subject discussions. And at the same time, the Neighborhood Congress, we tried to revive using the same, somewhat the same pattern. We had two excellent groups of speakers, one on the revenue cap in Wicomico County that was very well attended at the university here. And we had one on farming and the environment, which we held over at Warwick and was very well attended. And a lot of farmers came, and it was a very lively discussion, very civil discussion. And we're looking for issues such as the Bennett School issue or perhaps dealing with resolving issues, tensions between farmers and environmentalists. There are things that can be dealt with, and we would like to try to deal with.
We are open for questions, and just to get things going, I want to ask, I would be interested in their take on the fact that the McCain-Feingold campaign reform initiatives were, in effect, trumped by the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United. Why don't we start with Dr. Hoffman?
Anything that you would attempt to affect political change, I think, as illustrated by everyone on the panel, is often a multi-pronged approach. So, I mean, it's a matter of using electoral strategy, why it's so important, say, the presidential vote, right, who you vote for president. If a president has the opportunity to make a replacement on the Supreme Court, that will obviously change the decision-making on that court and can possibly overturn the Citizens United case. There are efforts being orchestrated right now at the grassroots level where you have a number of organizations that are attempting to get the decision overturned by constitutional amendment. Very difficult, extremely challenging to do.
There is another thing that is working its way through, and you probably will hear about it before too long. There is a decision of the Supreme Court of Montana just within the last month or two, which may have an impact on this whole process. And what it comes down to is that the opinion in the Citizens United case stated as a matter of fact, more or less, that the infusion of big money into politics does not cause people to lose respect for the political process. And the justice just basically wrote that as if it were a matter of common understanding, which many of us feel was preposterous, that it does bring disrepute. Well, the Supreme Court of Montana, a month or two ago, found as a fact in a case there that it did cause. In Montana, what used to be run by the copper barons, apparently, mm-hmm. I mean, it was an incredible thing where every elected official in the state of Montana 50 years ago was paid for by the copper barons, mm-hmm. and apparently it still is a major problem there. So the Supreme Court of Montana said essentially that the Supreme Court of the United States was wrong. They had no basis to say that because in our state, it certainly does cause disrepute for the political process, and therefore they held that they did have the right to restrict the flow of money into the political process. So that case is now being appealed, and it apparently is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's going to be very interesting to see what the Supreme Court does with that. There is some thought that even the justices on the Supreme Court who were very went the wrong way, we feel, last time around, may have had their eyes opened a little bit by what's going on this year in the electoral process. So I mean, I don't have a whole lot of respect or a whole lot of hope for there to be a radical change, but it's at least possible that they could use the Montana case as a springboard to at least soften or
play back the rule a little bit and say that, yes, there are circumstances under which the money should not be permitted to flow as freely into the process. There's also, I saw an article just 2 days ago written by someone who basically was a liberal who was saying that that the decision's not that bad. He said when they passed these strict rules on political contributions, to some extent, they are being proposed by the incumbents as a way to protect their incumbency. In other words, to keep money out of politics as much as you can protects the incumbent. And that maybe the Supreme Court was right, in at least in that respect, that maybe that putting more money into the system is going to elect some good outsiders. And I say he didn't convince me, but he did cite a whole bunch of states where he said, gee, New Jersey has really strict laws and they have terrible, you know, abuses. And Virginia has very liberal laws and they let money in, and Virginia's been relatively clean.
I'd like to ask all of your opinion about the use of petitioning. There was a very successful petition campaign in Wicomico County just a few years ago that was put on by the Wicomico County deputies that asked people to put on the put up for referendum collective bargaining with binding arbitration. This is in a county in Maryland. It's, if anything, certainly conservative on issues when it comes to support or lack of support for labor unions. And yet that petition was signed by a huge number of people, enough to put it on the ballot, and it got overwhelming support by the electorate. Vinnie, maybe we'll start with you.
Well, you know, first of all, at the state level, you can't do that. At state level, you can't petition to get something on the ballot to get enacted. You can, though, as we all know, petition to repeal something the legislature passed. And I worked on such a campaign in 1988 with Mike's help where we passed a law banning Saturday night specials, cheap guns used by criminals, and the gun lobby took it to referendum, and we defeated them. And as you know, this year we're going to have on the ballot in-state tuition for undocumented immigrants and probably the marriage equality law. So in Maryland, at the state level, you can only use it to repeal. But in situations as in Wicomico, where you can put positive things on a ballot, I think it is a good idea. My experience, though, has been at the state level in Maryland where you can't do that. Mike, do you want to?
I just comment that, Phil, I think that the petition there, I mean, from a political standpoint, was a little unique because it was the rare issue that united basically liberals who are labor people and conservatives who are pro-police people, you know, that they could get behind the same piece of legislation. So I think it's rather unusual that you're going to have situations like that, but that was one that did.
It's very unusual, Phil. Also, to have the police, which is the sheriff's department, asking people to help them makes a huge difference. There are very few things in this community that you could get to referendum that way. But when you have the sheriff's department asking people to help them so that the sheriff's department can help the community, that's a very different situation. And there are very few other things that would work that well. And as we know, of course, it didn't work with the county council. So,
here's a question from the audience for Vincent. How will Affordable Health Care Act enactment impact your efforts for health care in Maryland?
It's a great question. And, you know, a lot of the what's in the Affordable Care Act was built on successes in Maryland and other states. And the Affordable Care Act takes a lot of what we did and expands it a lot. It will expand health care nationally to at least 30 million people, including 400,000 or 500,000 in Maryland, and it will also result in more affordable care for all of us. I think the Affordable Care Act is a great law. President Obama should be really credited with being the first president since Teddy Roosevelt first tried to accomplish something like this. But one of the important facts about the Affordable Care Act is it gives a lot of discretion to individual states on how to implement it. And some states, as you know, are going exactly the wrong way, in my opinion, and they're trying to get it repealed or they're not implementing it well enough. Luckily here, Governor O'Malley, Lieutenant Governor Brown, Secretary Sharfstein of the Health Department are working hard to implement it in a right, correct, fully implemented for Maryland citizens. And we're working hard to make sure that the Health Exchange Board, which was created under this law, really has the authority it needs. And there's a piece of legislation right now in the General Assembly to do that. Among other things, it will give the board the authority to pursue methods such as primary medical care, which can keep healthcare costs down. Healthcare costs are going up. One of the main reasons is that there isn't enough coordination and people aren't, there isn't somebody making sure that you get the healthcare you need and not healthcare you don't need. So we're very excited about the Affordable Care Act's implementation in Maryland under the O'Malley Brown administration, and we're working hard to make sure it's done right.
Most small businesses weren't aware that they were eligible for a tax credit for giving health care to their employees if they hadn't had it in the past. So we have been working with the governor's office and with the local health department to try to get the word out about some of these features of the law that that deserve to be implemented locally.
You mentioned communications. I'll just say three or four words. Blogs, Facebook, Twitter, electronic media, how important have they grown in communication with neighborhood associations, with organizations that you all represent?
It's very, very important that you keep up with the media. And our Healthcare for All Coalition does the Facebook and Twitter to the hilt to get the message out. And it's also important to keep up with the public media. Newspapers used to be one newspaper or several newspapers in a city. That's where all the news came from, and maybe a couple TV stations. And now, as you know, that's exploded. And you have to make sure that you get your message out to all the media, including all the different blogs and all the different ways that people check on the media. So it's very, very important to keep up with that.
You don't have to go any further than the Arab Spring to know how important the electronic media is to any kind of cause. If you have an issue in which you're interested and you don't blog, you don't have a Facebook page, you don't tweet, you just as well forget it, because you don't exist for a demographic under the age of 45. You just don't. So that has got to be a part of any issue that you're pushing.
I mean, especially if the issue involves young people, but even if it goes, you know, in the older age demographics, you know, not only using this stuff, but knowing how to use it properly. In the future, we could actually do an entire forum on just using Twitter, Facebook, and blogs for a organizing, coalition building tool. There are experts that do this really, really well. And that might be a future forum we have specifically on using that electronic media to do some of the things that we talked about today.
We'd like to thank PACE, Leah Reynolds, the new managing director of PACE, Salisbury University, PAC-14, the Civil Discourse Committee, Dr. John Rutenberg, chairman, and our panelists, Dr. Adam Hoffman, Michelle Hughes, Vincent DeMarco, and Mike Prettle. Let's all give them all a good hand.
This has been a broadcast of the second of the Civil Discourse series, hosted by the Institute of Public Affairs and Civic Engagement on the campus of Salisbury University. This is Don Rush for Delmarva Public Radio.